This is Side B of session number 50, recorded on August 27th, 2007. And we're just beginning to do the Dobbs charts, and we're working on the first one, Bob Dobbs' formula chart. And the formula or equation is coevolutionary anticipatory mimesis equals how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics. It implies a sociological situation. Anyway, Scott, what was your objection about the telegraph and the numbering or something?
Oh, well, I think we cleared it up. It's just that I understand now that where you have telegraph listed under ALP, at the first category under ALP, that it doesn't mean that the telegraph had been invented. It means that the telegraph is the technology is moving in the direction of the concrescence or the manifestation of the telegraph, and that's happening during the period of 1750 to 1800. The telegraph actually manifests after 1800.
Right, and it's sort of like to show the invisible hidden ground of the ALP column, any of these things listed, it's invisible. They ain't there. Even though I'm showing them they're there in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
But the humans didn't know they were there.
Yeah.
And so when you have under HC the causes merging with effects, no causes is in quotes. That's not the technological causes or the teleological effect of the telegraph manifesting. It is the bureaucratic culture, European or American, and its cultural limitations and concepts about what it thinks it's doing to maintain power that the intelligence agencies use. It's those causes. It's almost like political causes. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why causes in quotes. And they merge with the effects, the invisible effects caused by ALP. They merge unconsciously.
Yeah.
They're acting out. They're miming effects that they're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But they're pretty close to being aware of because they're elites and educated and they have to deal with power and they know a lot more about sociological control of people than the citizens do, right?
Right. Is it a factor that ALP is feminine and that ALP heads up the half of the stage, the bottom-up ground effects preceding causes, or is it not relevant that ALP is feminine and HCE is masculine?
Yeah, you have the maybe Jungian idea of the feminine, which is based on the female character, the female form, the anthropomorphic feminine. But Jean Baudrillard, in his book Seduction, written in the late 70s, discusses the feminine as a strange process, not necessarily limited to people in the feminine biological form. It is the mysterious seductive effect of the invisible, what's called the other, the thing that's not you, working on you. And definitely technology, through most of its history in the last 1,500 years or 1,000 years, would seem to be in the mechanical phase of technology as an other, an alienating other that was confounding human organization.
Yeah, like, well, we associate the womb with the female, and so maybe the womb is the matrix, is the thing that's acting or massaging the developing thing inside of it.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor. That's the biological idea which Jung might be using. And there is the traditional tribal view that the feminine does certain things and the male does other things. And they have talents in different areas. And the nurturing aspect of women in the womb is certainly, even though the primitive cultures may not have known what the womb was, they didn't visualize it like we did, but they knew the woman nurtured something that created the baby. And that whole nurturing aspect of the woman led to preconceived assumptions about what the woman's role was.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the woman is represents the nurturing, the growing, and the mysterious, whereas the male is dealing with applied knowledge, with protection, shielding, keeping a lookout for things that can be dealt with, even if they're aggressive
mm-hmm.
or dangerous. So yeah, that's so the idea of the feminine as the invisible nurturing aspect is definitely included in the meanings for that left-hand column.
Mm-hmm.
And it's during the patriarchy, so the male seems to be in charge of the mysterious powers, you know, because they have the occult political intelligence knowledge, because it's a patriarchic history of Western empires where the left hemisphere part of the brain is in dominance.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be mysterious, maybe from the woman's point of view.
Yeah.
So there's two different aspects of the Mysterioso. I mean, McLuhan used to point out that The Godfather, the movie The Godfather, was mistitled, because he said that sociologists discovered that the mother, the godmother, was the real power in the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a similar idea, that it's always been a matriarchy.
Yeah.
It's that she stoops to conquer and maintains the power of the feminine.
Yeah.
In different ways as technologies change the society.
Well, in a matriarchy, we think of the woman, the image of the woman being out front and in power. But even when during the period of the patriarchy, what motivated men to go off to war was women in the background saying, "Look, you have to go. You have to protect your family. You have to protect me and your children." And they're behind the scenes providing the emotional power that motivates men to do what they do.
Yeah, and that's when the knighthood idea came in, and the idea of romance and individual sexual and emotional relationship called love would happen between a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it would violate and upset the tribal bonds and the tribal hierarchy. So the knights went off in search of something to get honor and prestige in relation to some queen or princess or powerful maid or something.
Yeah, I think the Templars, you know, prostrated themselves before the feminine image.
Yeah. So, okay, so we're explaining.
I just want to mention here, because it state the obvious. We spent four sessions on Bob Marshall's bottom-up chart and top-down chart, two separate charts, and this chart embodies both the bottom-up and the top-down.
Yeah, yeah.
Bottom up on the left side and the top down on the right side. So it's merging. It's merging the Bob Marshall's charts.
Yeah. Bottom up ground for ALP and top down bureaucratic ground. Bureaucratic implies writing materials, later print materials, that whole literate structure of power.
More content oriented?
Yes. McLuhan used to say humans were always the content of media. So it's about managing humans. And the managers of the humans are often confused and upset by the invisible technological environments and their new effects, which force new ways of controlling the content, which is the human. That's power.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always the hidden, unforeseen effects of the technological extensions.
Right.
So this is a largely McLuhan-oriented chart. It does have the bottom-up and the top-down merge, but McLuhan had the top-down in his later writings, especially in his book Take Today, The Executive's Dropout. It came out in 1972.
Yeah, but by then we were in what he referred to as the seamless web, top-down, bottom-up. It merged anyway.
Right, right. But people thought in the early 60s that he was leaving out the elements of bureaucratic power. They would criticize him for being apolitical or not political enough, but his point was that media were powerful political forces.
Mm-hmm.
And then later when figure and ground, medium and man merged, then he could start talking about the user as the content. So we did all that in the McLuhan section. So looking at the chart here, you got two, you have the idea of the stage. And because this really is, this chart, a picture of the 90s, what I call the Android meme, the global village phase in Bob Marshall's charts were superseded by the global theater stage.
But wait a minute, what's a picture of the 90s?
Yeah, this is a physical analysis of the constituents of the components of the 90s.
Oh, you mean the 90s replays 1750 to 1990.
That's right. The actual, in the period we know as the 90s, that's the after image of the Android meme. The Android meme is finished in 1990, and then the computer popularization that Wired magazine represented was the after image of the Android meme, in my terms. So I'm showing a picture of the Android meme and indicating this is its after image.
This is the period of time leading up to the Android meme, which then, would it be fair to say the Android meme is all of the elements in Bob's formula chart happening simultaneously within a new matrix or a new ground?
Yes, and that is illustrated in the second chart, the what we call the tiny node chart.
Yeah.
But let's go back to was explaining that you the stage, as you get into the seamless web, as you mentioned, there is no framework for a stage. Remember on the Bob Marshall charts, he had solar stage, universal
figure and stage merge.
Beg your pardon?
Figure and stage merge.
Right. So there is no stage.
And when does that period begin, the seamless web?
Well, radio was pretty seamless, but then TV completed it with the sight element and the kinetic, the visual element, so it had more senses than radio. And then
still developing from radio to TV, but when does it complete itself?
With the satellite, because the television completes the extension of the central nervous system, and then the computer extends the different parts of the central nervous system, and then the satellite extends the whole planet, whereas the TV and computer were extending just the human body form.
What do you mean by the now the central nervous system, it organizes or integrates the interplay of the sensorium, the human sensorium. That's largely what the central nervous system does, I think. And then you have the autonomic nervous system, which is completely unconscious. The sensorium's not aware of that, but that's running all the processes that support the life of the body, including secretion of hormones and heart rhythm and beat, metabolism and food digestion and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. McLuhan popularized the phrase of television as the extension of the central nervous system in the mid-60s. Then he puts out a book, which was a collection of his literary criticism from 1943 to 62. That book comes out in 69. He calls it The Interior Landscape. And that was a concept in poetry. But the interior landscape is what the phrase in central nervous system refers to. It refers to all the parts of us that we can't see. The pumping of the heart. McLuhan used to take the systole-diastole action of the heart pumping, and he used that as a metaphor.
Was that part of the central nervous system or the autonomic nervous system?
Well, biologically, it isn't. It's this or that. But that's why I'm saying he generalized the phrase central nervous system into the phrase the interior landscape. In other words, everything underneath our skin.
Oh, not only our organs of perception, but our vital organs.
Yeah, the action of the heart, the systole-diastole action. He uses that phrase in his book From Cliche to Archetype. And
well, how do we see the extension of the systole-diastole activity of the heart being extended into the environmental matrix?
You ask me?
Yeah.
What's the question again?
How do we see the extension of the systole-diastole activity of the heart extended into the environmental matrix?
When you see that, when you look at the heart and you look at the systole-diastole action, you can't actually get a frame around it because one part's going in, the other part's going out. You ever look at a pumping heart? It's hard to visualize all the components. That's another way of expressing tactility, which is integrating all the senses, and you couldn't see how it could do that. You couldn't see the pathways it's doing at the speed of light. So the tactile nature of the central nervous system and visual images of it is the in-and-outness that goes on with the systole-diastole action of the heart.
Yeah, but I'm not seeing how that's extended into the... See, I can see, if I think of the central nervous system as the human sensorium, I can see how we've extended our eyes, our ears, our sense of touch in a way, our sense of, you know... I don't see how we've extended our metabolism or our you know.
Okay. In the book,
blood, red blood corpuscles or something like that.
Well, let me tell you. In the book, Cliched Archetype, from Cliched Archetype, he talks about it being further along than understanding media, which that book just discussed the extension of the central nervous system the way you just said it, but the process of different media environments interacting inside the global theater caused by the satellite proscenium arch. Think of all the different media pulsating in the 60s. It's that collective intermedia action which tactility is expanded to include. If you were looking from the satellite at all the media environments interacting in all the countries on the planet, it would look like the pulsating of a heart, because you'd see processes going in and processes going out, and it would be hard to see every part of it.
You can see circulation of money, if you will, or circulation, like the blood circulating through, you know, vital substance circulating through the system, called the economy.
Or the Nielsen ratings, people watching what's going on the radio and studying the ratings there, then seeing how that applies to TV shows, and then to movie shows, and the newspapers, and what's the headlines, and then oil tankers floating in the planet's oceans. All these massive environments interacting.
Yeah, but I think that's a stretch to say that you can draw an analogy between that and your liver, your kidneys, your bladder, your heart, intestines.
You know, Joyce did that in Ulysses. Remember, a lot of this comes from Joyce. If you look at the chart he had for his 18-chapter book, Ulysses, he had a different organ for each chapter. So the idea that the body was extended by machines, it first comes from Baudelaire, who saw the city as an extension of the body organs. And that was developed by Joyce a little more comprehensively, then McLuhan applied it globally. So the intermedia action indicated in the book from Cliched Archetype goes further than understanding media, which is just dealing with the effect of the TV environment from the 50s and environments before that. So it's the extension of the central nervous system is represented by TV, but when you have all the environments pulsating in and out in the 60s inside the computer and satellite environment, that's where you get the intermedia action titled from Cliched Archetype.
Oh, so now I see why on the tiny note chart Bob is doctor/scientist, because just like we need a doctor to take care of the health of the chemical body, if the media environment is recapitulation of the biological body, then I guess we need a doctor to keep that healthy too.
Yeah, that's the science of media ecology, which McLuhan called the new science, and then I updated into the science of paramedia ecology.
Right.
But yeah, no, that's right. Dr. Scientist is not just the body healing problems.
Yeah.
It's the collective problems, which is what both these charts are trying to show.
Right.
See, that's why the word media archetypes is in there. It comes from McLuhan's use of the word archetype, which is an environment that has come, been invisible, and then become visible because it's superseded by a new invisible environment, and so it eventually becomes a guaranteed pattern of thinking, and therefore archetypal.
Right.
Even before it disappears into the ethereal under Android beam conditions.
Right. And it's being propped up by the collective brains of 6 billion people all processing the same media extensions.
Yeah. So you mean the Android meme is?
No, yeah.
Or the global theater, any of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, humans are interacting with it.
Yeah, and they're propping it up. I mean, one person can't prop up all of the media extensions, but 6 billion people all processing all of the media extensions.
Yes.
They're part of the ecology of
communication.
Yeah.
And McLuhan, in the 50s, said, I think it was in the 50s, early part of his career, he said that the television environment, this is before the satellite, reduces everybody to the individual, not the 6 billion, but the individual, to being a mere hydraulic jack. Now, that's an automatic pumping action, right?
Yeah.
So think of the propping up as a pumping action and a very mechanical, robotic thing symbolized by the hydraulic jack.
Right. have the four bodies, and if you pulled the chemical body, if all of a sudden the Andromeda strain killed off all the chemical bodies, well, the other three bodies couldn't survive because they are all integrated together.
Well, the astral body could survive if you believe we survived death.
Sure, the astral body could survive.
But
the TV and the chip body would collapse along with the chemical body because they're intertwined.
Yeah, a lot of it's computerized, so the tapes would carry on. Now,
well, only as long as they were getting electricity, and that means that the power stations would have to keep running. And these things aren't going to run indefinitely without human maintenance.
Yeah, because they're us. So since people think we're the chemical bodies, and if they go, then all that is part of the chemical body, which would include the TV and chip body, go too.
Yeah. But you see, I think we could eliminate the chip body and humans would still exist. I don't think we could eliminate humans and the chip body would still exist.
Okay, you're saying if we get rid of the chip body and we have the TV body...
If we eliminated the TV and chip bodies, humans would still figure out how to survive. They'd just go back to growing things and they wouldn't necessarily vanish from the face of the earth. But if humans vanish from the face of the earth, the chip and TV body would also vanish from the face of the earth. So I'm saying that the human beings are more fundamental to these four bodies than the TV or chip body.
Right. Well, it may sound facetious, but an alien civilization could come in and prop it up. But you could say that they're just substituting their chemical bodies. So the point is we're using language here to break up and confuse the obvious so that we can create new perception, because ironically, language and its extensions, these media environments, confuse perception. So we need to unconfuse and mystify. So if one keeps walking around emphasizing that when I dream, that ain't the same thing as watching TV. Yes, but when you come out of your dream and you communicate what happened in your dream, you're up against all the interpretations that different cultures have built up with their language systems or their peculiar cultural dream systems, technological dream systems. And so as I've said before, if you believe that there's existence before life and there's a soul, and the soul comes into this world, and then it interacts with all the humans created, that creates a lot of stress for the soul, as well as the particular spiritual purpose of the soul for coming here,
mm-hmm.
and which is usually targeted at interacting with somebody or some people to work out some patterns, what people call karma. But I wouldn't want to limit it just to the karmic thing. So you could say, obviously, humans are the core of all this, but language confuses that. It's the need for humans to have distraction. Not that distraction is bad, but it's actually the life force. And the distraction creates other problems. So we're using language to talk about the problems that language confuses and clarifies and paradoxically makes people forget that they're the root of things.
Mm-hmm.
So if people remembered that their bodies are the core of everything and that these machines wouldn't be viable without humans, then maybe they wouldn't be so enslaved by the machines.
Sure, yeah.
Or they wouldn't perceive that they're slaved by the machines. They may not be perceived.
Right.
So there's a level of a game going on here, a word game.
Yeah.
And McLuhan used to say that in the seminar.
Yeah.
Someone bring up, this is a word game. He says, yes, media is a game. And notice and understand media. The one chapter that uses the phrase, the extensions of man, is the chapter called Games. So the ongoing issue of whether Yogananda is right to say that his form of astral projection uses the technological metaphor of the West to get across the thrills of astral projection to a Western audience is relevant or irrelevant to the social confusion that goes on regardless of how many people are doing yoga, caused by the media environments and the new languages and words and terms that come up.
Yeah. And, well, the core of Yogananda's, of the practice of yoga that Yogananda practiced and taught was learning to, in the first stage of meditation, to withdraw the attention from the senses.
Right.
And then you would use a method of paying attention to subtle currents of energy flowing in the spine. As you became more absorbed in those currents, the currents that were circulating around through your senses would be, in a sense, withdrawn or pulled back into some core place inside the core of your nervous system or your brain or something. Then once you eliminated your identification with the sensory world, then you were free to move about in these other dimensions of yoga.
Right. Now, it definitely, when he's talking about the senses and the transcending of them, he's not thinking of the book as part of the sensory life or the television.
No.
Maybe to the degree you have to withdraw and go to a monastery or to a cave, that is acknowledging the external extensions of your senses in a way of withdrawing from them too.
Yeah.
But we know that the West has marketed yoga in a very less severe form.
Right.
You're supposed to do it at lunchtime during your workday break.
Yeah.
Rather than withdrawing to a cave, right?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting phenomenon, that the banalization of these esoteric traditions that goes on in our time kind of shows that the astral body and the energies of discipline that yoga advocated in relation to the astral body become slightly trivialized and not as prominent and severe in terms of how you develop them when you have the TV and chip body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the tradition that Yogananda was involved in was, the objective was to get into Nirvikalpa Samadhi, which was the realm of the sense. Once you had disengaged from the senses, you experienced this sort of cosmic consciousness that he referred to. I don't know what that is because I haven't had it. But other traditions, the non-dual traditions, said there's no distinction between Nirvikalpa Samadhi and the world of the senses. So you're being foolish by denying the world of the senses and withdrawing into this other dimension, because the dimension that underlies both the Nirvikalpa Samadhi and the world and the realm of the senses is the same dimension. So once you know that, it doesn't matter whether you're meditating or
gardening. We're writing accounting reports or going to the post office to mail them.
Yeah,
so that is an ongoing question about what are the boundaries of consciousness.
But the funny thing about Yogananda was all he wanted to do was go sit in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, and his guru said, no, you have to go to America and write this book, which became, has been a bestseller probably for 50 years or however long it's been published. It's a magnificent book.
That's the autobiography of a yogi?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and set up all these options. So he ended up, part of his, what he was required to do was to engage with language in the world and communicate this, what this yoga was all about.
This joke?
No, what the yoga was all about.
Yeah, yeah. It's a joke, yeah. They had to enter the meme of that sacred tradition into the global theater.
Yeah.
They had to be part of the battle for, to use the old cliche, the battle for men's minds, and see which tradition had the strongest wisdom. And McLuhan pointed out in the 50s that the battle by different cultures about their and preserving of their particular value systems and services won't be resolved. And media yoga, as McLuhan advocated, was a way of, note the phrase media yoga in relation to the autobiography of a yogi, he said that we need a new kind of detachment that does not fall for the battle between cultural traditions and memes.
Mm-hmm.
That was the new discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that discipline would recognize that the various claims of different cultures, which is expressed post-McLuhan as political correctness, that syndrome, but the claims of various cultures versus other claims from other cultures could not be resolved. So that led to endless dialogue and endless argument, which then makes people apathetic because it becomes just the media noise machine.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see in the tiny note chart that that's an image of the media noise machine made particular and kind of distinguished constituents visible because the paper or the visual eye version of the Android meme looks like it can be read and that you could make some order out of the noise.
Mm-hmm.
But you're being fooled by the image of it. If you think the Android meme can be parsed, as I've done in my chart.
P-A-R-S-E-D?
Yeah, the mm-hmm. term in grammar, where you analyze the syntax of language and sentences and word structure and position.
Mm-hmm.
It's called parsing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, the we won't resolve this argument between the definition and semantics of dreaming awake, but it is important to realize that the whole 6 billion people are dreaming awake collectively, what we discussed before as the super angelic state, whereas the yogi just develops the angel. What is it like when collectivities are dreaming or seduced by the latest environment that makes them see the patterns of previous environments and get insights from that?
Mm-hmm.
That would be like an active, powerful dream. What you learn from it, what you experience, is quite fascinating and seductive, but something you're inside a womb that you don't notice that's making you see the previous pattern as exciting.
Right.
That's why McLuhan said in our time, insights and ideas would be sold by businessmen, that insights and ideas would make the economy go. And he was implying that insights and ideas were not ground anymore, they were just figure.
Mm-hmm.
And people wanted insights every day
mm-hmm.
or pattern recognition. And that's why people watch talk shows, listen to talk radio.
It feeds some new stomach or need or
yeah, that's right, a new stomach in the TV and chip body that requires a sense of resolving the noise machine every day, 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Temporary resolution. So we have the phrase today, what's your take on this? What's your take on Gonzalez resigning? You know what I mean? What's your take?
Right.
It's a temporary thing. People don't say, what's your elaborated, reasoned opinion? And, of course, you could write an essay on it, but we haven't got time, so just give me a short abstract summary of it.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been maybe in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
The time of talk. But now people just, half bored, just ask a quick 15-second soundbite. What's your take on this or that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the expression...
Well, when you look at the political spectrum from the neoconservatism to the Hollywood Babylon and everything in between, and then you look at these, you know, guys that are out there trying to get your vote right now. They're, you know, running for, you know, Hillary's out there running. You know, when she's on in the media and she's trying to get your vote, she has to talk to something that's more essential about human beings than all of their concerns, ranging from neoconservatism to Hollywood Babylon. She has to talk to something that's fundamental enough to get everyone.
You mean to get attention?
Well, not to just get attention, but to try to. She has to try to cut across everyone's belief system, and try to hit a nerve that's fundamental to everybody, so that she can get as many. She can get the most amount of people to want to vote for her.
She has to come up with an image that everybody, the majority, can empathize with, or tune into, or resonate with.
Well, I mean, that cuts across all of the disputes and arguments and that are going on the superficially about what's, you know, about.
That's the role of the president. The president always tries to come up with a way of keeping people together.
Well, this president's not doing that at all.
Oh, yeah, he kept people together by not communicating. He got them very involved in energizing the information environment because it allowed more people to comment, more blogospheres,
yeah,
more media, more people talk and opinionate than ever did. So what do you do to get them opinionated? You create a void.
You create
a void that's not communicated to you, so everybody feels they have to fill it up.
So his job is not to get people to agree with him, because most people are disagreeing with him, but he's getting more people to participate at beating him up than has ever happened before.
Yeah. Hugh Kenner, who was a student of McLuhan, I think he wrote this in an article about McLuhan. After McLuhan died for like Harper's Magazine or something around 1986, he made an interesting point. He said the image of Reagan falling asleep on the job in meetings and that was really important in energizing society, because it made people feel shocked and vulnerable that the guy who was supposedly at the helm was sleeping on the job, and therefore nobody was in control. So this created a collective panic and led to all kinds of books and novels and movies and music and concern about this dumb president, this dumb actor president.
Yeah.
But it was like a black hole that motivated a lot of stellar activity. So that was Reagan. Then look what Clinton did once his penis surfaced, the discarnate penis. That motivated a lot of noise, which is wealth, information exchange. So then how do you counter that, or how do you up the ante? Well, you put a guy in there who can't even talk.
Yeah.
Which is another version of Reagan falling asleep.
But the thing that's interesting is that when Nixon got everybody participating during Vietnam, people united. They went out in masses into the streets. Now everybody's participating, but there's no capacity for people to unite.
There's no street space.
You don't see masses of people actually going out into the streets and demonstrating.
There's no street public space, and we analyzed using Croker why that was.
Yeah.
That's what Croker discussed. He got it from Baudrillard. Baudrillard's a sociologist who said there's no sociological space to analyze anymore. But that was their way of saying we've got a TV body, which is a new space.
Hmm.
So you have people, in this decade, we've archetypalized the expressing of your opinion or your take, and everybody has their own little blog where they can express their take. That is that is the social space that people think is what needs to be communicated within. And that's actually the communication after image of the TV environment. So the chip body has everybody being a TV broadcaster. The chip body being the womb, the invisible environment, and everybody commenting on the TV image of Bush.
Yeah.
Or Pelosi. Yeah. Or Hillary Clinton.
But there used to be the possibility of when a lot of people participated, for there to be a coherency in which they could participate as a big, huge group en masse and have some force.
Depends on the medium you use.
Now everyone participates.
Wait, Scott, and you need to, what medium? You're talking about the 60s. What medium was there available?
Well, TV and computers were on the way in.
No, people wanted to get on the news. The chant at the 68 Chicago riots was, "The whole world is watching." That was when there was one way, you know, three networks.
Mm.
It was a small TV space that you could invade.
Mm.
And they actually weren't even, you haven't had a public space really since before World War One, because you had the public space of radio, which was beginning to be discarnate. And then you had the TV age. But what happened when you got into the computer and digital and Android meme phase is that there wasn't one space that you broadcast to.
Mm.
There's a million spaces, a million fractals.
Mm-hmm.
So why would anybody look for a coherent image or a coherent space to operate in right now? The only space you have to operate in is your computer.
It's your own space, my space. That's
your own
the only space you have. We don't have a group space.
And the group space is always a technological medium that's being used. So the Android meme is the group space we operate in. And people, treat it in the rearview mirror by communicating to the TV body and the TV image. So there, so MySpace is commenting on what they consume in the electric media, or the electronic media. They list their favorite albums, their favorite movies, all old media.
Yeah.
And the idea, though, is to, that's the bait, and the idea is to acquire statistically, I guess, as many names on your space to indicate your crowd.
Yeah, and if you're really successful, maybe, you know, you got a few hundred to a thousand people who've noticed your space.
And have signed up to be part of your crowd.
And signed up to be part of your little crowd. Like you say, your little disappeared electronic or subatomic crowd.
That's right, and that's why Wyndham Lewis is interesting to read, reread, because he writes about the crowd master and the crowd dynamic as a key motif in his painting and novels and essays. The crowd master. Now everybody is the crowd master.
But when you were part of the human rights movement in the 60s, it wasn't a subatomic crowd. It was a Goliath.
No, it was subatomic, but people didn't perceive that. They thought there still was a public space. Now that's what happened in Paris. When the big crowd got together in the spring of 1968, the French students and the French workers, and went on strike and shut down the country, everybody thought de Gaulle was going to collapse. Well, a few months passed, and de Gaulle was still there. And the intellectuals, they were called the Situationists, and other intellectuals, lefties, right-wingers, whatever, Baudrillard was part of that crowd. Derrida was part of the crowd. All the people that Croker writes about in his book, The Possessed Individual, these people marveled at how de Gaulle survived this expression of a unified public space, a general strike, and why did he survive? Well, Baudrillard came up with one of the key answers. He realized that there was no public space. The people thought there was, but actually the new space was television. And that's why he started really studying McLuhan, because he saw McLuhan was on to this. And the fact that TV kept going, and de Gaulle was able to maintain an image of power and stability through TV to counter off the counteract the images of the riots and that, it was the TV medium that was the new space. So even in the 60s, which was the last gasp of this romantic social public chemical body space to be activated, turned out to be a rearview mirror interpretation and missing the new ground, which was television.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was inside the satellite environment, which was triggering this in cultures all over the world. So there wasn't just the French problem. There was the riots in Mexico. There were the riots in the campuses in the United States. There was the Maoist children's crusade in China. There was Czechoslovakia in the Soviet Union. The satellite was causing this sort of ecstatic explosion and attempt to recover the chemical body social space over the whole planet.
Yeah. But getting back, I'm not real familiar with all those. It's really interesting what you're saying, so I'm not trying to counter what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I'm not real familiar with all the disruption and riots in all the parts of the world. But getting back to what was going on.
Well, let me just say that
getting back
a book called 1968 came out a couple of years ago, where this American writer, I went to his book signing and got to talk to him, ask him a few questions, but he was pointing out how in 67, 68, when the video from the Vietnam War that journalists were getting were able to send through their networks and get it up on satellite, the beginning of satellite broadcasting,
mm-hmm.
So the merger of the satellite technology and the video technology in 68 caused, he said, the turmoil of that year. But to know what went on around the whole world, that's the book to get. I think it's just called 1968.
Okay.
Okay, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, getting back to the civil rights movement, that, even though maybe it was, you know, it was just a subset of all of these other movements, so maybe
yep.
It was tiny in a global storm. It was a small storm within a global hurricane. Nevertheless, it had the power to change American politics, and I don't think it's possible for people to get together and change American politics anymore.
Well, that's looking at the national stage, the national images. Nixon and them, as my chart shows, Nixon's on the chart, And we have the dynamic we'll go into about what he was subject to in politics. The puny institution of politics in the White House had to respond to this media technological landscape. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. I mean, there's the appearance and the belief, you know, that if we get out and vote, we can tip the ship, we can shift the weight, you know, to the left or to the right and make a difference in American politics. I don't know if that's true anymore.
Yeah, well, McLuhan started to point out in the 70s that the real power shifted from the national image stage to local PTAs. And in retrospect, a lot of the right-wingers and neocons and the fundamentalist American religionists infiltrated the school system locally, changed the school books, and brought in the creationist stuff. This was all done locally, which fit McLuhan's prediction that American public life would fragment and decentralize, and that the real political power was in the local educational committees and what's called the PTA, Parent Teachers Association.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a revolution going on locally, because the national centralized image was gone. And so the invisible effects of this didn't surface till the 80s with the right-wing revolution through the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
So there was all kinds of new ways of dealing with a shattered public space in the 70s and 80s that in retrospect people comment on. And you hear a lot of African-American professors talk about how, in general, the blacks, African-American chemical bodies, are worse off now than whatever they thought they got with civil rights. And civil rights was looking for a literate industrial vote, and that was rearview mirror. I mean, McLuhan said that Martin Luther King was a disservice. He wasn't talking as a racist. He was talking about the issues. And he said any major public figure, you know, Tim Leary, Martin Luther King, anybody of that period, including Nixon, were all rearview mirror images and causing blindness to the real issues, which would create new problems that nobody even foresaw. So all the problems that happened in the 80s and 90s that we've talked about in the economy and all kinds of breakdown in social stability was predicted by McLuhan because the new fragmented media would do that. So that, so I knew that back in the 60s. So one thing about living in New York City is you get to hear a lot of intellectuals in the Barnes & Noble's book launches. You know, they're coming through here every day. So I've interacted with a lot of famous people, professors in different fields. And for me, they're always proving what McLuhan said. It's not because that's the only way I can look at reality. And I actually bring up McLuhan and they agree. Or if they don't understand me, they disagree or this and that, but usually they acknowledge, yeah, there's something to what McLuhan said. And one of the interesting things is that he predicted that the African American was going to be exterminated.
Hmm.
And
it hasn't been though. They've been integrated largely.
Okay, but here's the thing: when you listen to people like Henry Gates, famous black professor, they are in despair because they. And they're ambivalent because they say, yes, there's a lot of affluence going on, but the middle-class affluent African-Americans aren't dealing with the majority of their people in the cities who are really in trouble.
Yeah.
And so they see that their people is being wiped out slowly. And that is what McLuhan meant, that the extermination for blacks has been the increased imprisonment of poor black youth.
Yeah.
All over
where the blacks that have been able to integrate into society have, you know, decided that they want to be like the rest of us and have a shot at, you know, the quote unquote good life. And,
yeah, and what is the good life? Consuming electronics and using your TV, having the ability to use your TV and chip body when you want to, and therefore the characteristics of the chemical body, whether you're Chinese, black, or white, or Jewish, are minor. And therefore, so it's not that the American blacks are merging with the American middle class. They are just not putting so much emphasis on their chemical body.
Uh-huh.
But the professors like Henry Gates come along and says, we got to be concerned about our fellow black chemical bodies.
Yeah.
The majority of them are disappearing and in real trouble in terms of not being educated or being able to engage in the modern economy.
Yeah, they just prisons are full.
And then the ghettos are another kind of prisons. So their chemical bodies weren't annihilated like the Jews were in the Holocaust, mm-hmm. but they have been rendered socially impotent in devastating ways.
Yeah.
At least socially impotent in terms of mobility and access to the four bodies.
Yeah, well...
And you can understand out of that despair, Nation of Islam surfaces and becomes a powerful source for chemical bodies, black chemical bodies, to have a sense of community.
They don't become impotent with respect to the four bodies, because the four bodies, like you say, have become social institutions. They're available to everyone, even in the ghetto.
Right. Now, some people wondered why the violence of the 80s in New York City seemed to really decrease in the 90s. We could say, I at the time thought it was due to the expansion of the chip body. So even though not all the African Americans had computers, they were in an environment of computers, and they had their cell phones, or they had their telephones or their digital Walkmans. There was all kinds of electronic media to channel the social energies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was another way of the TV body, chip body, being used and adopted by ghetto children or just the black population, so that they did not have the frustrations of the chemical body so prominent as they were in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and
they were siphoned off.
And the rhythm.
So it was a more peaceful city in New York City in the 90s.
And they were able to channel the rhythms of the street where they were living into the culture at large, and maybe siphon some of the energy off that way.
Yeah, they spend a lot of times they're out there making videos.
Yeah,
they may not make it, on a major economic success scale, but they were involved in making these things, filming themselves, videotape themselves, and having little studios. So. It was the making mania, the producer mania, the participation mystique happening again in extreme.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that is a way that peace came to the cities.
Mm-hmm.
At least peace in reference to the issues that were of concern and led to violence in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, public riots and that.
Right.
They still come back every now and then, like the Rodney King beatings and things like that. They show up every now and then because the chemical body hasn't totally disappeared.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sure.
And there were lots of protests starting with Seattle in 99, right?
Yeah.
But people say the effect of 911 killed that kind of chemical body resurgence of public space activity that made people think the 60s were back.
Yeah.
So we must be near the end.
Yeah, I'm going to say one more thing, and then you can either comment or wrap it up. And that is, since this, part A was on the chart, part B turned into a personal chat with Bob. We'll get back to the chart next week. I'm glad we're getting into these areas of discussion on the side. I'm going to contradict myself, because I said earlier, I don't know if Americans have the ability to affect the political power structure anymore with their vote. But yet I'm thinking back to when Gore won the election. I had a lot invested in that election, and I felt that I was satisfied. And then when it flipped over and Bush won the election, I thought, no, this isn't supposed to happen. This isn't right.
You thought Gore won that night in 2000.
Well, everybody did for a few minutes.
Right, right. And according to the media, by midnight.
Right, and then
they woke up the next morning and he'd lost.
And he'd lost and Bush had won, and I felt like, no, things are going in the wrong direction. This isn't right. I don't know. At the deeper levels of Bob knowledge, whether or not those are just my personal biases coming into play, or whether or not I was actually right feeling that we had just taken based on the election, which may or may not have been thrown, power had an opportunity to move in one direction or another, and so it did make a difference that it moved in, that it fell into Bush's lap, that we would might be actually living in a different the political image and force of the United States might be in a different position today had Gore become president.
Right, and according to my chart, if you understand the chart, you would need to look at the dynamics between ALP, Shemshon, ISI, and HCE in 2000 that led to 2007. That's what we're dealing with here. How does the technological ground and the intelligence HCE attempt to control interact with the qualities of the medium of that time to create the conditions that, if you follow my chart, are predictable?
So that'll be where we'll pick it up next week.
Right. We need to go from, we'll work towards that.
Yeah.
Because we need to go into, under Shem, we have technological / cultural enemy. Under Sean, technological / weaponry. And under ISI, anthropomorphic sociological / psychological mask / leg. And they're all considered figures, but I call them actors. In brackets, retrievals and interiorization. Think of the phrase interior landscape. Interiorization of archetypes within the stage. So ALP and HCE are the stage structure that the actors, the kids, mime their effects on.
Mm-hmm.
And those effects are what technology is seen as the enemy, what technology is seen as the weaponry, and what is seen as a comforting respecter of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Personal and sociological.
Mm-hmm.
The comforting aspect of ISI, while Shem and Sean conflict with older technologies as their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they fight and who's going to win is determined by the structure of the stage, which is ALP and HCE.
Right. Yeah. Actually, you just reminded me something with the conflict between Shem and Sean, because I noted Abraham and his children, and then you noted
Noah,
and actually this goes back to Adam and Eve. Didn't their children end up on two sides of this?
Yeah, Cain and Abel.
Cain and Abel, yeah. So that, this goes all the way back to the source of human myth.
Yeah, so that's so you see Cain and Abel in Finnegan's Wake. He has all the culture's myths embedded in there,
mm-hmm.
but he also brings in the effects of forms, technological forms.
Right. Yeah, they become the the new personification of the well,
the old pattern of cultural myths.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right, we gotta stop it. And good chat, Bob. Fireside chat with Bob.